Greetings, I'm Fred Zaspel. Welcome to another author interview here at Books at a Glance. Today we're talking to Dr. Alan Kirshner about his book, A Linguistic Approach to Revelation 19, 11 through 20, verse 6, and the Millennium and the Binding of Satan. Alan, I think this, welcome, glad to have you with us. I think this was probably your doctoral dissertation, am I right on that?
Yes, it's just a slightly revised version of it that was published with Brill, yes.
Yeah, okay. And you did your work under Stan Porter, right?
Correct.
Yeah, great. All right. Survey for us just briefly in broad overview the various understandings of the binding of Satan in Revelation 20, and then we'll get into your book.
All right. So the basically, there's two very broad views on the binding of Satan or the millennial debate, if you will. And that is what I would call a temporal historical or a temporal based understanding and a thematic view. So the temporal based would include, for example, the premillennial, amillennial, postmillennial views. So they would say that the millennium itself, however, whatever length it will be, will be realized in history itself. It's a temporal base. There's going to be a realized in the time period. Whereas a thematic view would say, no, there's no, that's, it's only a symbol. It's there's not an actual period of time, but it's a symbol, and different thematic millennial scholars will explain it sometimes differently of what that represents. But part of the most common view is that the millennium represents the victory of the saints. And within the within this broad understanding of the millennium, you have within the temporal period, as I mentioned, the post-mill, all-mill, and premillennial views. You have would be the sequential and non-sequential views. So sequential views would be the post-millennial view and the premillennial view. The amillennial view would be the non-sequential view. And what I mean by that is, it's basically the debate is, really the millennial debate is all about, when does the binding of Satan begin? Did it begin at Christ's first coming, or will it begin during the inter-advent period, or will the millennial begin at Christ's second coming of Christ? The temporal historical or the sequential view would say that the binding of Satan and the victory of the saints are consequent events of the victory of Jesus in Revelation chapter 19. Whereas the non-sequential view would say the binding of Satan is not a consequent effect from the victory of Jesus in Revelation 19. Rather, it's non-sequential in the sense that the binding of Satan and the victory of the saints in Revelation 20, they are recapitulated to the inter-advent period. So they precede the parousia. They don't follow the parousia. So that would be a way to categorize the main views, is the sequential versus the non-sequential.
Yeah, break that down just a little bit more, especially with regard to the post-millennial view. How would they view Revelation 19 and 20 in within this consideration?
The post-mill view would say that the parousia in Revelation 19, the victory of Jesus at the battle in Revelation 19, was realized in the first century, or some would argue maybe the second century. So they would view it as the future parousia of Christ associated with the resurrection. They would see it in terms of the first coming of Christ, and that would be followed by the millennium itself. So and let me just note also, again, post-millennial interpreters are in disagreement with each other on exactly when the binding of Satan happens. Some would say it's happened at the first coming of Christ. Some would say it's happening early in early church history, or it's going to happen in church history at some point. But yeah, so they would still see it as a sequential event, that the right. First coming of Christ or soon after was the parousia. That was the Revelation 19 event, and that would be followed by the millennium. That's why they can still be considered the sequential interpretation because they don't agree with amillennialists, where amillennialists would retroject or recapitulate the binding of Satan, the victory of saints before the millennial period. Hope
Very
that helps
good.
to
Very
clarify.
good. Very good. All right. Talk to us about your distinctive approach to the question and to the passage. Fill us in on the Greek discourse analysis and those kinds of things. Take a few minutes here if you need to. Explain how this should be a contribution to the study of Revelation 19 and also to eschatology generally.
The millennial debate, or the question in Revelation 19 and 20, I mean, at its core, this is a cohesion question. So it by cohesion question, I've alluded to this already, that the whole debate, of course, the millennial debate is not about the length of the millennium. That's a
Right.
debate, but that's not what the millennial debate is. The millennial debate, again, is all about when is Satan bound? Is he bound at the first coming of Christ? Is he bound during the church historical period, inter-advent period, or will he be bound in the future at Christ's future parousia? And so, how one relates Revelation chapter 19 verses 11 through 21 with chapter 20 verses 1 through 6, how they relate those two passages, whether they're cohesively part of a single cohesive unit, or whether they are two, to use linguistic terminology, are they two separate semantic environments, as the amillennialist view would have it? That is the question. How are they related? So it's a cohesion question. So it follows that what we should use a robust linguistic tool of cohesion or methodology to apply to this question. And so what I so chose a very robust and well-known tool from systematic linguistics called cohesive harmony and information flow. And these are tools that, they identify whether a text or two texts are cohesive with each other. And so it's different layers of cohesion. So my book is my dissertation. Revised dissertation, and it's the first, and as far as I know, it continues to be the only linguistic approach to the millennial passage in Revelation. So traditional approaches, to this text has been, from maybe different theological methodologies or literary methodologies, but this is most appropriate here to address a cohesive question with a cohesive methodology. And the problem is, without, because when I approached this, I was like, I was, thinking about my dissertation and what to write on it. And it just kind of hit me, like, almost without exception, interpreters, when they approach this, the millennial passage in Revelation, they always, almost without exception, even many premillennial interpreters, they begin at Revelation chapter 20, like right in, they kind of skydive right in the middle of the context and without any explanation, actually. And so, especially since, Revelation 19, they don't explain why Revelation 20 verse 1 begins a new semantic environment. So what they do is then they'll have, I mean, we can, except for post-millennials, amillennials and premillennials agreed that the parousia and the victory of Jesus at the parousia, at the battle in Revelation 19, that's in the future. And so that's in the future, and the amillennialists would agree that the consequent effects of that victory punishes the armies and the nations and the two beasts. But then they stop there. I think wrongly, because the context, the semantic ties, the links, the environment, it continues into the punishment of Satan. So when all millennials come to Revelation 20 verse 1, all of a sudden we're told that, oh, this is a context of the first coming of Christ. The problem is there's no indicators, or to use linguistic terms, there's no markers, there's no discourse markers or signals that indicate that this is a that the context has changed. So I find it odd that we have the occasion of the punishment of the two beasts and the armies, right there. It's the victory of Jesus. But why don't we have the occasion of the punishment of Satan? Well, we do. It's in the context of Revelation 19. It's the victory of Jesus. There's no semantic break. This is a key point in my book. There's no semantic break between Revelation 19, verse 21, the last verse in chapter 19, and the beginning of chapter 20. So there's no shift. It's a continuous, semantic, cohesive, unified passage, and we cannot build a brick wall between Revelation 19 and chapter 20.
Yeah, very good. This is a subject that's long interested me, but I've never put the amount of work in it that you have. The consecutive Kais coming through the 19 and 20, things like that, and also the pieces of information that are consistent between 19 and 20. So let's look at some of those that you've done in your book, Revelation 19 and 20 specifically. What indications of what you call cohesive harmony are evident from 19 and 20, and explain how that's significant?
Okay, it's kind of interesting you mentioned this, the series of Kais, and I don't even mention that in my dissertation of 90,000 words
Oh
as an
boy. Okay.
argument. As an argument. I'm not saying that is not an argument in itself. I just didn't think it's very significant compared to these other
Right.
pretty compelling cohesive links. And it's kind of interesting because sometimes I've heard all millennials kind of caricature pre-mill is like, well, they just argue that there's a consecutive Kais and da da
Yeah.
da, and therefore, and it's like I don't even use that as an argument. It's not even for me. There's much
It doesn't
deeper
seal it.
cohesive. No, yeah, it right. But so I what I do is I identify cohesive ties between these two passages. Again, Revelation 19 verses 11 through 21, and the other passage, Revelation 20 verses 1 through 6, and identify these cohesive, they're semantic links or ties. We can call them links. I call them ties in the book. And there's different types of cohesive ties. There's referential and semantic and so on. And I lay that out in the book. And they create chains. And so when you have links between two passages, you create this chain or a thread. And I also use that term too. I like the term thread. And even within these threads, going from Revelation 19 or two passages back and forth, even the threads themselves, the chains or the threading chains, they actually interact with each other. And that's what's called cohesive harmony. So that gives a kind of a vector. It's even a more of a solidified cohesion between these two passages. Because yeah, you can have similarities between two passages, but that in itself does not indicate cohesion. But when they start to interact with each other, as I explained in the book, then you have then you have what's called coherency, or it brings about coherency. So anyway, let me just mention that there's a host of them, but I'll mention five of them. And I note them here for this interview that I think your listeners will appreciate. So, for example, what I call the downward movement link in Revelation chapter 19, verse 14, you have the it begins the context begins in the deixis would be in the air or at heaven, the point of origin in heaven, and then it moves to mid heaven. In verse 17. And then in chapter 19, verse 19, it moves to earth. Well, we can't stop there because the downward movement, the cohesion continues in chapter 20, verses 1 through 3, moving now to the abyss. So it goes from heaven, mid-heaven, earth to the abyss. That's a chain or a thread, a cohesive thread. Another one is the judgment link. As I alluded to this earlier. So in chapter 19, verses 20, the beast, along with the false prophet, they are, and this is interesting, the same lexical terms are used. They're seized. I'm not going to use the Greek terms here. I'll just use the English glosses. They're seized. They're given indictments. They're thrown. They're into ice or ace. And then fifth, there's an incarceration in the lake of fire. And then in chapter 20, verse 2, the judgment link continues, but here it's focused on the ringleader, Satan. Number one, he's seized, given indictments, thrown into incarceration, into the abyss. So his punishment, his ultimate punishment, is delayed for 1,000 years, but still he is incarcerated. Then there's the what are called the worshiping beast link. And in Revelation 19, verse 20, it talks about so they giving the reason why they are punished, because they deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshiped his image, and then their punishment. Well, in Revelation 20, verse 4, there is a contrast. It's not those who have worshiped the beast now in Revelation 20. It's rewarding those who have refused, who had not worshiped the beast. But if you break the the semantic environment, you start a whole new context in Revelation 20.
Yeah, right.
This contrast is missed on the reader. The first century reader or listener of the book of Revelation would not have thought, oh, okay, Revelation 20, verse 1, of course, you know, chapter breaks are later in church history. They would never have thought that this
right.
is a whole new context. They would have understood that the occasion of the punishment would have been the victory of Jesus. Just two more real quickly here. The deceive link, and this is something that's been known in premillennial literature, the deceive link, that is, so Satan uses the beast to deceive the world through taking the mark and worshiping his image. Chapter 19, verse 20. And it says, the angel then threw him into the abyss and locked and sealed it so that he could not deceive the nations until the 1,000 years were finished. Again, if you break the unity, if you begin in chapter 20, verse 1, you don't understand the purpose clause here. The purpose clause kind of, it comes out of nowhere. Well, so that, what's going on here, right? Well, the understanding, the explanation of the so what is explained in chapter 19 about the deception. And then finally, this is a very interesting one, and I'm surprised this hasn't really been noted in a lot of literature. I call it the rest link. So in Revelation 19, verse 21, the rest were killed by the sword that extended from the mouth of the one who rode the horse, and all the birds gorged themselves with their flesh. And it says, the rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were finished. Again, if you start at Revelation 20, verse 1, like, wait, the rest of the dead, who are the rest of the dead? You have to go back to Revelation 19. That's a strong cohesive link. When you have that, you know, the antecedent referential cohesive tie in this last one. So those are just, you know, those are five of them that I just wanted to highlight.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Now talk about information flow. That's closely related to that in a way, but here you seek to nail your argument down tightly. So sketch that out for us. The consistency of information flow from 19 and 20.
So information flow is another tool that gives another layer of cohesion. And what I did in one of their chapters, I identify markers showing the nature of the boundaries of the passage. And this is where, and I should also note, I don't believe that Revelation 20 verse 6 is the end of the passage. I actually believe it goes into chapter 15. The reason why my book, I focus at the end of chapter 16, because I'm answering a specific question on the establishment of the kingdom, of the millennial kingdom. So it's the establishment, and all the data up to verse 6 is important for that question. But I do bring in other data that goes up to verse 15 that I needed to address, especially when I'm identifying what I call the section of the passage. So for example, here on, this is on page 126, one of the arguments for information flow is showing the semantic boundary markers in Revelation 19, verse 11 through 20, verse 15. And of course, one of them is lexical distribution, which actually is all the data of the cohesive harmony. So I just kind of recap that. But I also get into the Revelation 19, verse 19, 11, and verses up to chapter 20, verse 15, as boundaries. Now, again, if they're boundaries, that indicates, that strongly implies that Revelation 20 verse 1 cannot be a new semantic break. So I just mentioned a few of them. There's a, for example, there's a shift in the spatial deixis from Babylon the Great in Revelation 17 and 18 to heaven in chapter 19 verse 11. Then there's a switch from personal participants to impersonal participants. This is shown in chapter 21 verses 1 through 2 onward, where the spatial and the personal deixis shift from chapter 19 11 through 20 verse 15, and then the instances of Adon, and then anyway, I could go on. The point here is that there's markers that kind of like bookends, if you will, that enclose chapter 19, verse 11 and 20, verse 15. Again, indicating that this is a cohesive, unified section. And I give the structure of the section and the paragraph. So basically, there's three main paragraphs within this larger unified section. Paragraph one is the pronouncement of judgment. That's chapter 19, verses 11 through 18. Then paragraph two, there's an aftermath of the judgment, chapter 19, verses 19 through 20, verse 3. And then there's the finality of judgment. And so you have the pronouncement, the aftermath, and then the finality of judgment. And that indicates, once again, that there cannot be any, that there's no semantic break in this section. So now, what I did with my last chapter is, which interestingly was not even something I was going to include in my dissertation, but the more I thought about it, it's actually quite important. And that is looking at cohesive information flow and cohesive ties in Revelation broadly in the text, because I really wanted to focus tightly on the context of Revelation 19 and 20. But I realized, and of course, my supervisors encouraged me to, they were saying, hey, there's some important, interesting lines of evidence connecting this passage and to the larger broad discourse of Revelation. So I'll just mention a few of those. And that is, so again, in Revelation 19 and 20, I'm arguing that the three adversaries of God, they're punished at the same time. You can't disconnect their punishment from each other. And so one of the arguments for that is that when you look at the discourse, the three, when you always look, whenever the three adversaries function together in the remaining part of the book of Revelation, they function as a unit. For example, the three adversaries in Revelation 12 and 13, they solidify the world's allegiance and go after God's dissenting remnant. They do that together. That's the first phase. The second phase is in Revelation 16, where it's showing that they're preparing the armies of the nations to go after God himself. So no longer the remnant, now they want to go after God himself. And then the final phase depicts them in Revelation chapter 19, verses 21 through 20, verse 6, as well as chapter 20, verse 7 through 10, culminating in the aftermath of the battle with their consequent punishment. So you can't disconnect, you know, the punishment and Satan and retroject that back 2,000 years earlier. And, and what I like to say here with some alliteration, it may help, is that in Revelation 12 through 13, they're scheming together. In Revelation 16, they're summoning together. And then in Revelation 19 and 20, they're being sentencing together. So another, finally, just one last one is the nature of the abyss. Besides all the, you know, the terminology in Revelation 20, you know, with, you know, he's being thrown in, locked, sealed, all that. For me, that language, those lexical terms, items, they indicate an absolute view of confinement. So in other words, Satan has, that language indicates that he will have zero influence on the outside of the abyss. So he has zero influence. And so it's kind of interesting that amillennialists will say, well, he has some influence in this way. It's like, well, when you look at the terminology, he doesn't have much influence. And when you, especially if you look at Revelation 13, Revelation 13 is, and amillennialists would say that Revelation 13 describes Satan or the beast is at his par excellence, career, right? He's,
Right.
you know, even says, you know, Satan is, you know, he's thrown down to heaven. He has, you know, with great wrath because
In
his time is
chapter
short.
12, yeah, that's chapter 12, and it says he's deceiving the nations.
He's deceiving the nations, exactly.
Right.
And he, so there's a lot of, I think there's equivocation going on when they say, well, that's deceiving in Revelation 19. It means this over here. But then it's like, what, when you read Revelation 12 and 13, Satan isn't just bound a little bit. He is unbound. He is, again, par excellence. So there's a contradiction, I think, in their understanding. But the nature, what I really focus on is with the cohesive ties is, well, I was like, well, where else in Revelation does it talk about the abyss? Well, in Revelation 9, it says, then the fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star that had fallen from the sky to the earth, and he was given the key to the shaft of the abyss. He opened the shaft of the abyss, and smoke rose out of it like smoke from a giant furnace. The sun and the air were darkened with smoke from the shaft. Then out of the smoke came the locusts onto the earth. And they were given power like that of the scorpions of the earth. I'm sorry, but the first century reader, after hearing that, would not come to the conclusion, oh, the scorpions, even though they were in the abyss, they still had some influence on the earth. No, then why say locusts came up onto the earth? Because now they have influence on the earth. In other words, it implies strongly that when they were in the abyss, they were locked up. It wasn't a relative confinement. It was an absolute confinement. And so we have to infer that when we go to the abyss passage in Revelation 20 with Satan. In fact, Satan's language, that's even stronger than what we have in Revelation 9. So I think the only conclusion is that when Satan is bound in the abyss in the future, it's an absolute confinement. He has no influence. He will have influence one more time when he is released at the end of the 1,000 years.
Well, John stresses that point on the binding of Satan, that he's thrown into the abyss. It's covered over, sealed up. He's in a chain. The language could hardly be stronger about the absolute binding. It would
if
seem.
Language means anything, you know,
yeah,
and
right,
again,
right.
It's hard to imagine that the first century reader would come to any other conclusion.
Yeah, right. Okay, so in your argument, you've established a sequential reading, I think a premillennial reading of Revelation 19 and 20, and you've done it on exegetical grounds. I think that's what's important, the important contribution that you're making. Now, I'm sure you've thought of this. Is there any remaining exegetical work that needs to be done here with regard to objectors from the other side? What needs to be done further?
Well, I think my ultimate goal here is to, and I began working on it, is kind of a second volume, and that is a second volume that continues the exegesis of up to verse 15 and actually even into chapter 21, because I want to respond to thematic millennialism as well. And so my focus was to really engage the question on the establishment of the millennium. Now, I realize that there can be some objections with like going into the passage where it talks about the end of the millennium. And that is, you know, with Gog and Magog and the Great White Throne Judgment and so forth. And there has been some arguments out there that have from all millennialists and thematic millennialism has tried to argue that trying to identify Gog and Magog battle with the Battle of Armageddon in Revelation 19. I completely disagree. I think these are two distinct battles. So that has been an objection, and that's something I'm going to be engaging in pretty thorough too in my next volume.
Cool.
But I wanted to really, again, I wanted to focus on this. For me, the heart of the millennial debate is if it can be established that the occasion of the binding of Satan is the victory of Jesus at the Parousia in Revelation 19, then for me, that's the debate. I think I've accomplished that if I can accomplish that, if someone
I think so.
if make a case for that. So
well, that is where the matter turns, that's for sure. All right. Well, we look forward to the second volume. We're talking to Alan Kirshner, author of A Linguistic Approach to Revelation 19 and 20 and the Millennium Binding of Satan. It's a real contribution to the work. If you're going to study eschatology and the millennial systems, you haven't finished until you've looked at this argument. I think it's that good of a contribution. It's important. Alan, thanks for talking to us. Great work. And thanks a lot.
Thanks, Fred.